seems like a very healthy sangha, a lot of things happening. We're in transition. Well, I thought I'd talk tonight about, we were having this class at Green Gulch. I called it Study as Practice. And we've been meeting together talking about studying as practice. And I thought I would give you a version of the talk I gave the first class. Now, when I was a student at UC Berkeley back in the 60s, maybe some of you were a student back in the 60s, there were very few books on Buddhism at the bookstore, and even fewer on Zen Buddhism, which is my lineage. But over the years, there's been this exponential growth in books, you may have noticed. Are any of you currently reading a book, or two or three? on Buddhism or Zen Buddhism or this or that, motorcycle maintenance and Buddhism. At Tassajara Zen Mountain Center during the summer, there's lots of workshops, and I remember a couple of years ago they asked me to do a workshop, and I looked at the workshops that were going on, and it was like Zen and archery, you know, Zen and cooking, and Zen. And so I thought, well, I just do one on Zen. And that seemed to work out pretty good. There are some people who just, you know, want to sit. You know, there are just so many books. And don't you feel sort of a greediness about the whole thing? I mean, you see this new book, you know, and it's by a teacher that you perhaps know, you know, or had heard of. And they look so beautiful now. You know, it's sort of like wine labels, you know. The best artists are, and you just want that book, you know. And I was giving a talk at Green Gulch one Sunday, and during the question and answer period, this woman raised her hand and asked, was concerned and anxious about all these books, and that she didn't know what to do. She was putting in a lot of effort, you know, like trying to, you know, make some progress on these books, but it seemed that every book she read, then four more would appear, you know. And it sort of reminded me of Ulysses. You know, remember when he we cut the head off of, what was that?
Hydra.
Hydra, and then eight would appear. Just losing ground, you know. So it does bring up the question, I think perhaps many of us feel it. How do you approach this whole matter of study, books, words, concepts in our practice? And that was what this class was about. And I thought, oh, this is a great idea. Let's have a class on this. And then, of course, you got to do it then. And it worked out actually over time. So you're probably familiar with, or may be familiar with, the Zen Manifesto attributed to Bodhidharma, who lived around 500 current era in China, sort of the father of Zen, supposedly. And the manifesto had to do with a transmission beyond the scriptures, beyond words and concepts, direct pointing at mind. This manifesto of Zen. Yet, there are libraries. You go to a Zen monastery and there are hundreds and hundreds of books, people reading everywhere. Talking when they shouldn't be, and thinking about Buddhism and the Dharma. Now, what do you do? How do you think about this conflict? This seeming, I know at Green Gulch, and it's true generally speaking, you know, there's this beautiful library, and then there's this Zendo, and the two are sort of like balancing, like a teeter-totter. And the Zen literature is full of stories about people getting brought up short because of their attachment to language and concepts, fixed viewpoints, the source of suffering, distrust, you know, of language. Book after book, scripture after scripture was written on this subject. So one of them, for instance, I'll mention a couple, was the story of Tokusan around 850 Common Era in China. And he lived in the north of China. It was like the north and the south of China. And Buddhism was thought to be different in the north and the south. And Tokusan was in the north. And he became this great expert on the Diamond Sutra. It's a wonderful sutra. And wrote many commentaries on the Diamond Sutra, studied, collected commentaries, probably had a class at Zen Center on the Diamond Sutra. And he heard about this guy in the south of China, which is where sort of, you know, the Bodhidharma kind of, which talked about, you know, transmission beyond words, beyond concepts, direct pointing at mind. And he thought, well, this is blasphemy. He felt that he was being undermined in his studies of the sutras, and the whole school of the north was being undermined. So he packed up his commentaries on his back and walked off to the south to stamp out this heresy down there, and trudging along like Zen monks do in China back in the old days, and with a bowl, a staff. This guy, you know, was carrying all this heavy weight of probably karma, right? All these commentary. He's going to go down there, and his mind was on fire, they say, and he was going to really, really do some good down in the southern part of China. So he went down there, and he was going to. You heard about this guy named Rutan, and he went down, and when he was white, he got pretty close to the monastery of Rutan, and there was this little stand along the roadside, you know, one of those little stands with rice cakes and whatever, tea. And the usual old lady was in there cooking the tea, and this is, you see them in a lot of these stories, the old lady, you wouldn't notice her, and she's cooking, and the monk goes in and says, he asked the old woman to let him have lunch to refresh his mind. She asked, well, what sort of literature is that you're carrying on your back? Knowing that's what Zen monks, if they're going to carry anything from the north. And he told her what it was. And she said, you know, these old ladies, you know, like, you sort of like are a setup, right? Because they seem like, oh, they're just an old lady, right? But they know everything. They're wiser than anybody. Anyway, so she says, I heard it said in that sutra, because he said it was a Diamond Sutra. She said, I heard it said in that sutra that the mind of the past cannot be grasped. The mind of the present cannot be grasped. And the mind of the future cannot be grasped. She said, now, I would like to ask you, what mind are you going to get refreshed by lunch? And Tokusan was dumbfounded. And then, anyway, he went up and he found the monastery. And one thing, there were other stories, but eventually his mind opened, and the story goes, and he studied with the teacher for many years. And at one point, he was seen out in the courtyard taking a torch to the commentaries and the sutras, you know, burning them in the courtyard. What do you think of that? You think that's a good idea to burn the sutras, burn your library? Huh?
No.
Okay. So the poor guy depended on the sutras, and I guess he thought his liberation, if he burned them, he'd get rid of them or something. But, you know, I hope he didn't hurt himself, you know, when he was trying to burn these sutras. And there are examples like the Blue Cliff Record, which is a collection of koans, 100 koans. Once they were written, you know, koans, little story interactions between Zen master and student that bring up a kind of a dynamic conundrum of the Dharma, and are just as fresh today when you read them as they were back then. But what happened over a period of time was people started thinking about, well, what's the answer to that koan? You know, so as if a koan had an actual answer. And they would write them down and pass them amongst each other and memorize them. And then when the teacher called you in, and then you'd give, you know, the thing. See? And it got to be corrupt, right? Like everything gets corrupt, including Buddhism. And so there was an attempt, a few people tried to collect and burn all the commentaries and the blocks that they make the sutra. You know, they got those and burned those. But fortunately, unfortunately, of course, some survived. So today we still have these koans. There are many stories like that. One last one I'll mention is in the Book of Serenity, the third story, the invitation of the patriarch of Eastern India, it's called, the third koan. A Raja of Eastern India was invited the 27th Buddhist patriarch to a feast. You know, I mean, if you're a Raja or like a king or an emperor, this is what these guys did, right? That's what you would. You just invite over who's ever the smartest, wisest, most interesting people, and maybe have them discuss things in your presence. And yeah, that's what you do, right? If you're an emperor, right? So he invited the patriarch over, the Buddhist patriarch. And he asked the Buddhist patriarch, "Why don't you read the scriptures?" This is what he wanted to ask. This guy didn't read the scriptures. Everybody else was reading the scriptures, arguing about the scriptures, discussing the scriptures, copying the scriptures, painting pictures of the scriptures. This guy. So he said, "Why don't you read the scriptures?" And the patriarch said, "This poor wayfarer doesn't dwell in the realm of body and mind when breathing in, and doesn't get involved in myriad circumstances when breathing out. I always reiterate such scripture, hundreds, thousands, millions of scrolls." Sometimes I get a visual image of, you know, those party favors where you like that, and I kind of go, and these scriptures rolling in and out. It doesn't get involved when breathing in inner concepts and attitudes. It doesn't get involved. Not that they're not there. Of course, they're there, as we may notice when we meditate. But, oh, there they are. They're definitely there. But he doesn't get involved in them, he says. And when he breathes out, he doesn't get involved in the myriad circumstances, you know, get hooked on, you know, get involved in things. Not that they're not there. And of course, this we can go into, oh, what about social action? Shoot, we get involved. You know, but let's not go there. So Zen seems to have an anti-intellectual bent. Now, the story sort of emphasizes this kind of thing. Burning textbooks. destroying printing blocks. Enlightenment after brief encounters. You know, little things happen. All of a sudden, somebody's enlightened. They didn't even have to do any work. You know, what kind of thing is that? Thomas Aquinas, the great Catholic theologian, who he lived around 1500. Very productive guy. Summa Theologica, which is his work, is like that. It's very thick. Anyway, Thomas was a brilliant guy, and he lived in this little hut, and he would, well, I don't know whether it was a hut. Anyway, a place he lived in. And he would each day get up in the morning and would walk along this path in the country. There's a stream going like this. And he would go over there, and there would be a church. And he would go into this church, and he would say Mass. And then when Mass was over, he would go over here, and there was another building, and he would go in there. And in this building, when you open the door, you walk into this building. There were all these people, all these secretaries, you know, and people working on his books and revising and editing. And he would go in and then he would start to dictate and read and this incredible production thing. And he was amazing, the guy. I don't know whether you ever studied any of this. But brilliant man. Very spiritual, too, but very rational, you know. Proved the existence of God through reason. How many are there? Six proofs or something like that? You know, various proofs. Anyway, one day he was walking up that path. This is after many years and many volumes later. Walking up that path, and he was looking, and he saw. He looked at the water of the stream, and the sunlight glinted off of it. And he looked, and all of a sudden, everything dropped away. And this, he was amazed, and he didn't know what to do. And he walked along, and he walked into the church, and he said Mass. And then he walked over into that room with all those people, and he dismissed them all. And then he went home. And he said, it was all as straw. You know, all his work was just as straw. He dropped, as they say, body and mind. He let it all go. That's a wonderful story of St. Thomas Aquinas. I studied him. I hope I didn't waste my time. Thomas. How do we explain this contradiction, you know, between all the studying and but in Zen, like huge amounts of literature, and this danger, you know, like watch out, don't get hooked on words and concepts. You know. Well, Dogen talks about the topic in this phrase, the painting of a rice cake, which basically is the idea that you know, a rice cake, the painting of a rice cake is not a rice cake. Big distinction there. Which may mean that words or concepts will not liberate you. Talking about liberation won't liberate you. Only experience beyond concepts, beyond words. What could that possibly be? Like St. Thomas, right? I mean, he wasn't trying to drop it all. It just happened. Divine intervention, maybe. Dogen develops the view that language or study as such, as words and concepts, are not the problem. But the use of words and concepts to explain and describe things, we start getting into trouble. He argues that all experience is mediated by concepts and language, like right now. Right? I mean, you want to name things or, you know, tell stories about what's going on now. Roof, floor, me, wall, I don't know. There's a concept for every experience. There is no other world that is knowable. all experience as we know it is more or less the experience of language representations and learning. The whole universe and the whole Dharma is not anything else but a painted rice cake. This is a painting. It's moving. It's a kinetic painting, you know, but it's a painting. It's nice. It's good. I like it. Humanity, life. But we're immersed in this. This is our life. This delusion is our life. So this is where we practice, not someplace else. We don't get rid of this. This is it. And we use language and concepts to unwind ourselves from language and concepts. That's the effort of the use and the reason for study. So this tradition is designed to free us from the prison that our usual relationship with language creates. Words do not represent real, unchanging, substantial objects or truthful, fixed views. They're just words. There's nothing else. They are the play of life in awareness. Suffering, then, is grasping at concepts, getting stuck in fixed views. That's death. It's cold and doesn't move. We want to keep moving. Move it or lose it. You know, when you look up a word in a dictionary, what do you see? Any word.
More words.
More words. And then you could look up each one of those words. And you could. And each one of those words is defined by other words. And you wonder how many times you have to do it before you sort of exhaust 90% of the dictionary, right? I mean, you, probably not too many, and then all of a sudden, yeah.
This thing that happens, if you look up a word, you take the primary word, by five words you'll be back at the same word.
Is there, yeah, it really keeps moving, yeah. So that's it, see? I mean, it's all like this kind of flux, this kind of dance of concepts reflecting each other and supporting each other. And you think, well, is there some like right word, right kind, correct definition? There's just things holding hands and dancing. Just this is it. And we look at each other and say, oh, there's this and there's that, and I name that, and that's it. Yeah, sure. But we have to let go over and over again. You know? Everything is participating in a vast, fluid meaning space, each word completely dependent on the definition of all other words. He reaches down to pick up one word, and the whole universe moves, you know. You move one word, and it all moves, you know. Ripples out, you know. Is there any absolute, unchanging, true meaning? Something to take refuge in? To hide in? A correct definition? Life unfolds. Everything is impermanent and changing. Are you getting nervous? Our job is to remain awake and dance with the play of it. But we want to find a nest, a secure place. But over and over again we find we have to move on to somewhere new. As Dogen says, when we bring our fixed agendas forward to all things, that is delusion. when we have an agenda, right? You have each one of us. You could probably think about what your agenda is. You know, some of it's out of awareness or whatever, but neurotic. But we have our agendas, and then something shows up in awareness, and then we bring our agenda to it, and we like it, don't like it for this reason or that reason. It fits in, doesn't fit in, is useful, isn't it? From a small self-ego grasping point of view, this agenda. Things arise and then our ego goes, aha, you know, and uses it somewhere. When we bring our fixed agendas forward to all things, that's delusion. When all things come forth and validate and recreate us moment by moment, that is liberation. Or as Suzuki Roshi says, in a beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in expert's mind, very few. So that's kind of the background. That's kind of the background of with the class. I mean, you got to say all of that, and then you put it to one side and get concrete about things. And I'll just go through some of the thoughts I had about study as practice. First of all, I mean, why do you study? Why do you pick a book up? I need to be inspired to some degree. It's helpful. You know, it's wonderful to read about inspiring people, inspirational thoughts. I know there's something that is helpful there. You have pictures. Study can kind of inform and inspire my practice. Practice can be hard, can get dry, doubt. You know, it's hard to get back on that cushion. Why sit on a cushion? So study can be helpful there. And I mean, if you find something that inspires you, you should venerate it, or somehow, yeah, I'm going to say, keep it, get it, grasp it. You know, write it down, put it in your pocket. Get an 8.5 by you know, like one 5 by 8 card, and write down the thing, whatever. Stick it in your pocket. And every time you reach in there for your toll change or whatever it is, there it is, take a look at it. And sometimes a book will like occasion an insight that'll open your mind. Of course, you know, you don't want to get too, yeah, that's, enjoy insights, enjoy. You're going to have to let that go, you know, but it's such a blessing, such a gift. An insight. Father Dunstan, who has this little hermitage, Benedictine, in Sonoma County, I went up to visit him, and I asked him about study, and he thought about it, and he said, "Well, when people realize that insights are gifts, it's not like you're having an insight. It's a gift. It's a blessing." Then you can stay relaxed. You know? That's Father Dunstan. Anybody know Father Dunstan from Sonoma? At San Quentin, half of our group are lifers, so I like to tell them about the Buddhas and the patriarchs and the great historical figures and stories, as it peoples the practice world with inspirational individuals. They're kind of become part of a village. We all can become part of a village peopled by those individuals and those stories, you know. They don't have to be just Buddhists. Teresa, Mother Teresa. And study also feeds my mind with wholesome images. So, you know, we're getting a lot of images out there, right? A lot of not so wholesome images, a lot of violence, and so on. It just, you know. So, study can kind of give you wholesome images, stories to dwell on that feed your mind. Kind of counteracts some sense, or at least balances the negative stuff. I mean, read the paper, you know. I remember they started that paper once called Good News, and they would only put good news in it, remember that? Yeah. It went broke. When I was down at the monastery for many years, I had this little book by Huang Po. It was a Buddhist teacher, and I don't know, a Chinese. And the little phrase, little paragraphs like that, and you'd read them, and they really, really kind of like your mind to go, huh? And it would open it up a little bit. And I'd always read that just before I went to bed. Just before, I'd have it right there, and I'd kind of bring it, and I'd read one of those, you know, wonderful things that Wang Po used to say. And then turn off the light and go to bed. And a friend at Tassajara during the Zen workshop that we were doing told me that, I mentioned that to him, he said, well, actually, every night when he went to bed, he always read a little Dogen, you know, which, something poetic would be good. Something that sort of sinks, you know, beyond the words right away. Keeps the wheels turning. The Benedictine monks, you know, the rule of Saint Benedict has in it a schedule which includes study as part of the deal. Lectio Divina, it's called, divine study. And they would, there's a lot of literature on it, it's really great stuff. They would start reading, and then they'd kind of run into a paragraph or a phrase where they would kind of, you know, it would kind of like stop them, and then they'd just stay there with it. and it has to be the right kind of material. You know, the Bible kind of lends itself to this sort of study, but also certain kinds of scripture, the Buddhist scripture certainly. And he would stay there, and then there's several stages to Lectio Divina. I'm looking at the clock. One is, you take the phrase or whatever it is, and you sort of really look at it. Koan, right? Koans are like this because they're kind of short. But it could be just one word even. And you look at it, and then you sort of look at each word, or maybe look at each letter. You know? I guess in the Torah, you can really get into this. I mean, you just stay on the first letter for generations, you know, and really get into it. Look up the definitions, get very concrete about the word, about the words. And then you sort of get released from it. You know, it just will happen. That's enough. And then you move on. And then you go through things this way. But it's good to take on some phrase that suits you and stay with it. Breathe with it. So the first is, you know, we read and we get attracted, let's say, to Buddhism or something through hearing about it or reading about it. And so there's this kind of first stage of hearing and reading and something about it attractive. And then we sort of like start studying it and we sort of say, well, does this suit me? Is this reflecting anything? Is this useful to me? And you start taking it in and relating it to yourself. And then after a while, that's the second level. Look, the other thing is called meditation. The third level is called prayer, which, you know, if you're a Buddhist, you go, what am I going to do with this level? It was kind of interesting. It's more like, it's an action. You pray it, you know, like, go ahead, ask for it. You know, now you've got it, now you say, okay, come on. I remember being down at Tassajara one time, and there was this thing like, sentient beings are numerous. I vow to save them is one of the Bodhisattva's four vows. You go, I vow to save them? And it was really, I was, how can I do that? How can I take that vow? What? Doesn't that seem, so I was really into it. I was just thinking about it, and I wasn't going anywhere, and I had resistance to it. And then, so, and I remember asking for help. And I asked for help. Not, I mean, just, you can do it. You know, it's okay. You can just ask for help. You don't have to, you know, worry about, you know, any, like, oh, we mean there's a God and there isn't a God. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. You know, you can just go ahead and ask for help. And then I went down to the stream and I received something that allowed me a feeling of understanding. When I was work leader at Green Gulch, in the morning, what you do in a community, you all get together in a circle and you look at each other, and then there are announcements are made. You know, there's a little ritual that goes on. And one year, I was the work leader, so that means that I was the one who led the meeting, and we would offer incense to the Buddha as part of the thing. And I was in a kind of a tough spot there, having a little sort of problems and with afflictive emotions. I would go to the, when I offered the incense, I would ask for help. Nobody knew I was doing this, but I would offer the incense, and I'd ask for guidance or some, I need some, help me out, you know, I mean, show me, give me some, you know, just, you know, and then, okay, and then you go on with your day. And I have to say that I very rarely have asked for help, but I always receive help. And there's a saying in Buddhism and Zen, anyway, that inquiry and response come up together. That is, we ask, you receive. If you truly ask, the answer is right there. When you ask your deepest question, the answer is immediate. But you have to ask. I don't know what that means, what ask means. But I have this sense that I have to ask. I can't just sit around. And, you know, you got to do something. Yeah. I mean, or do you? Maybe not. Okay. Well, sorry, gang. Well, I don't know. I'm going to have to. I think you get the idea. What is the idea? this is the idea, right? So, as a Zen practitioner, I try to enter study. And now, one thing about studying is to take care of the things you're studying, the book. Where is it? What condition is it in? What does it feel like when you pick it up? Do you actually look at each page? Do you actually turn the page? Do you actually put the book somewhere? Do you take care of the things that you're studying with, the paper and pencil? Do you honor all of this? Because this is your life. It's no different than everything else in your life. Bring your whole presence forward. Take care of the details. Suchness, practice suchness is taking care of details. Well, I'm going to take care of a detail here. I'll just read you a poem, okay? Wallace Stevens. It's called "The House Was Quiet and the World Was Calm." The house was quiet and the world was calm. The reader became the book, and summer night was like the consciousness being of the book. The house was quiet and the world was calm. The words were spoken as if there was no book, except that the reader leaned over the page, wanted most to be the scholar to whom his book is true, to whom the summer night is like a perfection of thought. The house was quiet because it had to be. The quiet was part of the meaning, part of the mind. The access of perfection to the page, and the world was calm, the truth in a calm world in which there is no other meaning. Itself is calm. Itself is summer and night. Itself is the reader leaning late and reading there.